This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Coming up next, welcome to Blind Cricket, a rising phenomenon. Yelp and TripAdvisor, two business review platforms for travel and more. Plus, technology, accessibility, health and community news. From Mind's Eye Radio, this is the Blindness and Disability News Hour. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the program. This edition covers the week of September 14th, 2025. Hope everyone is well and staying cool as summer reasserts itself this past week. We've got lots of interesting stories for you this week, so let's get started. For our first story this week, we're going to pay a visit to Future Reflections Magazine, a publication of the American Action Fund for Blind Children and Adults. And this is from their summer 2025 issue and the Breaking New Ground department. Welcome to Blind Cricket, a rising phenomenon. This is written by Abby Finklia and introduced by the editor of Future Reflections magazine. When I met Abby Finklia at the 2025 Midwest Student Seminar in Chicago, I had never heard of the adaptive sport called blind cricket. Abby's enthusiasm was contagious, and I invited her to share her story with the readers of Future Reflections. She eagerly seized this opportunity to spread the word about this exciting new opportunity for blind athletes. And here's what Abby has to say. Less than a year ago, in the fall of 2024, there was not a whisper about competitive blind cricket in the United States. Yet, somehow, in the fall of 2025, the national U.S. women's blind cricket team will travel to India to compete in history's very first Women's Blind Cricket World Cup Championship. For any sport to grow so quickly is remarkable. It's all the more amazing when the sport is blind cricket, which was nearly unknown only months ago. Gathering momentum. Although cricket is the second most popular sport globally, falling just behind soccer, it is not commonly played in the United States. Despite this challenge, blind cricket has gained a strong foothold in the U.S. in the past year. For the first time in blind sports history, this U.S. blind sport is growing up alongside its mainstream counterpart, rather than waiting for the mainstream sport to become deeply established in U.S. sports culture. Furthermore, the women's team is being built up first, whereas typically women's blind sports don't develop until long after the men's sport has taken root. The seeds for U.S. blind cricket were sown in July of 2024, when the Cricket Association for the Blind in India provided a blind cricket demonstration at the NFB National Convention in Orlando, Florida. At the time, blind cricket was completely off my radar. Although I was aware of mainstream cricket as a sport, I knew almost nothing about the game. I never guessed that attending the blind cricket demo at convention would completely turn my world upside down, dropping me into international adaptive sports and a whole new life abroad. It might seem overly dramatic to make such a claim, but as you listen, I'm sure you'll come to see just how profoundly my life changed because of cricket. My initial attraction to the NFB blind cricket event stemmed from my interest in traveling to India, and the sports aspect was only a secondary motive. Of course, I was eager to try the sport, but most importantly, I wanted to explore options for volunteering in India. I saw the event as an opportunity to network with India's Cricket Association for the Blind. That was the extent of my expectation when I arrived at the event. Yet by the time I left an hour later, I found myself agreeing to help establish blind cricket in the United States. More importantly, I received an invitation from the organization's founder, Dr. Mahantish, to travel to Bangalore, India for 1 month to learn cricket. A journey to India. Although my brother Drew was not with me at the blind cricket event, the instant I told him I was traveling to India, he was eager and ready to leave with me. I had met India's Cricket Association for the Blind right at the beginning of its U.S. tour in early July. By the time the group headed back to India in late September, Drew and I had our visas approved and our tickets booked. We were set to arrive in early October. We were warned to expect severe culture shock when entering southern India, but we slid right into our new lifestyle. We fell in love with the languages, the people, and the culture of Bangalore. Upon arrival in India, I knew only the most basic information about how blind cricket is played. I had experienced the adapted ball, which is similar in size to a standard cricket ball or baseball, and filled with small metal ball bearings that rattle loudly. Unlike the traditional leather ball used in mainstream cricket and American baseball, the blind cricket ball is white and made of hard plastic. I had also experienced the bat used in blind cricket, which is nothing at all like a baseball bat. It is made of wood, and one end is wide and flat, somewhat resembling an oar or a paddle. I had only the most basic understanding of the game. I knew that one person throws the adapted ball toward the batsman, and the batsman must hit the ball. Beyond that, I was hopelessly lost. From day one, my life in India revolved around cricket. During my first week, I attended a training camp of 25 women in Karnataka State. While my fellow cricketers lived in a group hostel for a week, I walked from Dr. Mahantesh's house and joined the group first thing each morning. I arrived for training at 7 a.m. and remained until 6 or 7 p.m. Not only was I engaged in deep immersion in cricket for the first time, but also in the Karnataka State culture and language. Few of the women in the camp spoke English. Since I lacked the ability to communicate with body language, I quickly picked up my first words and phrases in the local language, Kannada. Although the coaches attempted to provide me with instructions in English, the language barrier made it challenging for me to pick up the sport. Nevertheless, I quickly fell in love with the feeling of playing on a team and building my skills as a cricketer. After I finished my week in group training, I transitioned into daily one-on-one coaching sessions with Lokesha, or Loki, one of India's longtime national players of blind cricket. All day, every day, 6 days a week, Loki trained me alongside Kavya, a state player for women's blind cricket. As I trained under Loki, I was preparing myself to bring my new skills back to the United States and pass them on to others. The rules of the game. Many people like to compare cricket to baseball. The truth is that baseball was developed based on cricket, and it carries many similarities. Rather than running to bases, cricketers run between two base-like structures known as wickets. There are two wickets on the cricket field, positioned at opposite sides of the pitch. The batsman stands next to one wicket, while the bowler stands across from them, at the opposite wicket. Once the bowler throws the ball toward the batsman will strike the ball before running across the pitch to the bowler's wicket to score one run. Meanwhile, members of the bowler's team, known as fielders, are spread throughout the field. Once the batsman strikes the ball and begins running, the fielders must retrieve the ball. The fielders attempt to get the ball to the wicket before the batsman finishes running. If they can beat the batsman to the wicket with the ball, the batsman will be out and another will replace them on the pitch. One team will bat exclusively for the first half of the game, while the opposing team will exclusively bowl and field. Halfway through the game, their positions will reverse. The team that was originally batting will begin bowling and fielding while the bowling team takes up the batting. At the end, whichever team scores the most runs is the winner. One of my favorite things about blind cricket is that very few adaptations have to be made from the mainstream sport. The major adaptation is the ball, which is a hard leather ball in mainstream cricket. For blind cricket, a hard plastic ball was developed, filled with metal ball bearings as a non-electronic auditory adaptation. Aside from this, all of the equipment in the sport is the same as that of mainstream cricket. The two other primary adaptations made for blind cricket are the batting and bowling styles. In mainstream cricket, the ball is thrown overhand, bouncing on the ground just before it reaches the batsman. In blind cricket, we throw the ball underhand, much like the regular bowling style, so that the ball makes a clear sound when it rolls toward the batsman. Due to this adaptation, the batsman may choose to stand and bat like a mainstream cricketer, or they can lean down and swipe the entire length of the bat against the ground in a powerful sweep shot. Apart from these three primary adaptations, blind cricket is very similar to the mainstream sport. Often people watching blind cricket don't even realize that the game has been adapted into a blind sport. I cannot count the times people have mistaken me for a sighted cricketer. When they find out I'm playing blind cricket, they are completely perplexed. Bringing it all back home. Once I had learned the basics of blind cricket, it was time to take the game to America. However, I was very reluctant to leave India. After just 1 month soaking up Indian culture, I came to see my new community as family, and I was addicted to playing cricket every day. My only consolation was that my brother and I would be working to build blind cricket from the ground up in the U.S. It was a daunting task, but teaching is a passion for both of us. The challenge of establishing a national sport was exciting and empowering. I wish I could say that the U.S. blind community welcomed cricket with open arms. The truth is that it took time and extended exposure to build interest in the sport. Many people had never heard of mainstream cricket, let alone blind cricket, and at first they were hesitant to try a new sport. The first step was to begin the exposure process, showering the blind community with information about blind cricket. During November and December 2024 and January 2025, Drew and I focused solely upon online outreach. From NFB email lists to blind sports networks, we blasted the community with news of our intention to start national men's and women's blind cricket teams. Although it took time for interest to build, once it was there, Drew and I found ourselves in a whirlwind of excitement. We were bombarded with requests for us to provide in-person demonstrations. By the end of January, our calendar was completely booked up through May, and we had 15 clinics scheduled in 8 states. We traveled to schools for the blind, such as Perkins, the New York Institute for Special Education, and the Maryland School for the Blind, where we held all-day clinics with students. The focus of these clinics was to introduce the youth to a new sport and to teach them the basic skills of the game. Most importantly, our goal was to give the students a good time. I say this effort was a definite success, as the students at many of these schools are still asking for more cricket. In addition to teaching at schools for the blind, Drew and I traveled to adult training centers such as Savvy Services in Arizona and the Louisiana Center for the Blind. We traveled to state conventions and blindness-centered events where we spread the word about blind cricket and invited people to join us on our journey toward forming the national men's and women's teams. Building the spirit, creating a team. It's hard to believe that in November 2024, blind cricket was largely unknown in the U.S. Now, in the summer of 2025, we just finished our first national training camps for the first U.S. women's team. Often, Drew and I feel like proud parents. We have breathed life into this project, and now we've watched the birth of a new sport in the U.S. Soon we will see the impact that it's having on the lives of our players. No feeling can compare to this. Not only will the game shape me as a person, but it will affect those who have taken the initiative to jump into a new sport and give it their everything. In the second half of June of 2025, 24 women traveled from 11 states to attend our first two national training camps for women's blind cricket. 12 players trained for 3 days in New York. The other 12 traveled to California the following week for their own 3-day camp. Throughout this journey, there have been many magical moments for me, but nothing compares to the experience of seeing 24 women come together to take on a completely new challenge. During clinics, I only worked with players for a few hours at most. But during these camps, I spent 3 days with the women and got to know each of them as we learned and played together. The magic of these camps came from the way the women interacted with each other and with the sport itself. I watched them build each other up and bring the absolute best out of one another. Any activity has the power to bring people together and to change lives, but never have I witnessed this phenomenon so closely before. I've seen these players restructure their lives around cricket and each other to build a strong, resilient team of incredible women. With this achievement under their belts, the women who have been selected to progress through the program will attend an intensive 8-day training camp from July 26th to August 3rd. During this camp, the women will dive more deeply into cricket, learning the intricacies of the sport. At the conclusion of this camp, the top 17 players will be selected as our very first National Women's Blind Cricket Team. Rather than easing into their role as international athletes, these players will jump straight into the World Cup competition in November of 2025. With only a few months of training to prepare, these dedicated athletes will travel to India and Nepal for 1 month to make history in the first ever World Cup for women's blind cricket. Although the United States has lagged behind other nations in mainstream cricket, we are right up at the top for blind cricket. We are right on time to compete in this historic event. It's hard to believe that there was almost no interest in blind cricket back in November of 2024. Now, exactly 1 year later, the U.S. will compete for the World Cup. This remarkable feat is a reflection of the strength, passion, and tenacity of our U.S. athletes. They have embraced change and joined forces to create something new and beautiful. Someone always has to be the first to take a step toward change and progress to inspire others. These athletes will inspire generations to come to embrace change and dive wholeheartedly into new athletes. If you take only one thing away from this article, I hope you are as inspired as I am by these women. I hope to see you cheering at the U.S. National Women's Blind Cricket Team on during the World Cup this November. Our next story on this week's program comes from The Guardian, and you can find them online at theguardian.com. U.S. government sues Uber, alleging discrimination against disabled passengers. The Justice Department in a lawsuit accuses company drivers of routinely refusing to serve people with disabilities. And this comes originally from Reuters, and it was published on Thursday, 11 September. The U.S. government sued Uber on Thursday, accusing the ride-sharing company of violating federal law by discriminating against passengers with disabilities. In a complaint filed in San Francisco federal court, the U.S. Department of Justice said Uber drivers routinely refuse to serve riders with disabilities, including people who travel with service animals or stowable wheelchairs. The department also said Uber and its drivers illegally charge cleaning fees for service animals and cancellation fees to riders who are denied service. Some drivers also allegedly insult and demean people with disabilities or refuse reasonable requests such as letting mobility-impaired passengers sit in the front seat. Quote, Uber's discriminatory conduct has caused significant economic, emotional, and physical harm to individuals with disabilities, unquote, and violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Justice Department said. Uber said in a statement that it disagreed with the allegations and was committed to expanding access and improving the experience of riders with disabilities. Uber also said riders who use guide dogs or require other assistance, quote, deserve a safe, respectful, and welcoming experience on Uber, full stop. We have a clear zero tolerance policy for confirmed service denials, unquote. The complaint describes Uber's alleged mistreatment of 17 individuals. They include J.E., a 7-year-old amputee from the Bronx, New York, who was allegedly denied a ride home from his brother's birthday party after an Uber driver looked at his wheelchair and asked, "Is that coming?" Another was Jason Ludwig, a Gulf War veteran with a service dog, who was allegedly denied a ride to the Norfolk Airport in Virginia from Newport News, missed the flight, and had to drive 16 hours home to Yarmouth Port, Massachusetts. A third rider, Jeff Clark of Mount Laurel, New Jersey, allegedly had 4 drivers in Philadelphia cancel rides in a 17-minute period after he told them he was blind and used a guide dog. The lawsuit seeks an injunction barring further ADA violations. It also seeks upgrades to Uber's practices and training, monetary damages, and a civil fine. A Justice Department spokesman had no immediate additional comment. Our next article for this week's show comes from MSNBC, and you can find them at msnbc.com. In seeking something to blame for autism, RFK Jr. wrongly attacks Tylenol. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. continues to sow discord and disinformation about autism and characterize autistic people like me as nothing but burdens. And this is written by Eric Garcia and published on September 9th. The news from the Wall Street Journal on Friday is that Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. plans to announce a link between Tylenol use during pregnancy and autism in children, and it is a return to a regrettable past when autism was routinely blamed on something mothers had or hadn't done. More than 80 years ago, autism was blamed on a presumed lack of affection from parents. Later, Kennedy would help whip up public sentiment that autism is caused by vaccines. The science doesn't show that. It doesn't show that autism is caused by acetaminophen either. In fact, scientists and doctors say acetaminophen is safe to take during pregnancy. But Kennedy is reportedly about to argue that the active ingredient in Tylenol, which is also found in other over-the-counter pain medications, is a culprit. The Wall Street Journal also says that Kennedy plans to promote folate as an autism treatment. Kennedy continues to sow discord and disinformation about the disability and to characterize autistic people as nothing but burdens. Earlier this year, he maligned us when he said autism, quote, destroys families, unquote, and lamented that, quote, these are kids who will never pay taxes. They'll never hold a job, unquote. Though NBC News has not confirmed the journal's reporting that HHS plans to link Tylenol to autism, Kennedy has said that he would make an announcement in September that would identify a cause of autism. As NBC News reported last Friday, quote, one of the more robust studies to date, published last year in the Journal of the American Medical Association, found that taking acetaminophen during pregnancy was not linked to autism, ADHD, or intellectual disability, unquote. There initially appeared to be, quote, a very small increased risk, unquote, of autism related to acetaminophen, NBC reported, but, quote, after the researchers compared siblings within the same family, one exposed to the drug during pregnancy and the other not, they found no link, unquote. In 2023, a judge ruled against plaintiffs suing Kenvue, Tylenol's parent company, claiming that the drug caused autism. The judge said the plaintiffs' expert witnesses failed to support their conclusions with sufficient scientific evidence. Scientific evidence has always been in short supply from those who are certain that they've got autism all figured out. In the first widely read study about autism published in the United States in 1943, Dr. Leo Kanner, an Austrian-American psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University, who observed 8 autistic boys and 3 girls, found, quote, "In the whole group, there are very few warm-hearted fathers and mothers," unquote. While Kanner cautioned that the children had an, quote, "innate ability," unquote, to form connections, years later he described the parents of autistic children as, quote, "just happening to defrost enough to produce a child," unquote. Austrian psychologist Bruno Bettelheim went even further when he said, quote, "The precipitating factor in infantile autism is the parent's wish that his child should not exist," unquote. A survivor of 2 Nazi concentration camps, Bettelheim compared these purportedly cold parents to Nazi prison guards and recommended, quote, "parentectomies," unquote, that is, cutting the parents out of the children's lives. It would take years to dispel the idea that autism was caused by cold or unwilling parents. Parents such as psychologist Bernhard Rimland helped debunk the idea. Ironically, though, Rimland believed vaccines played a role in causing autism. He was at the first congressional hearing that featured a conversation about autism and vaccines with Andrew Wakefield, a physician who would later lose his medical license for putting out the faulty study connecting autism and the MMR vaccine. During the first hearing, members of Congress and witnesses said they were grateful that Rimland had helped relegate the, quote, "refrigerator mothers," unquote, trope to the dustbin. Even so, most of the discussions about the causes of autism have either directly or indirectly blamed parents. For example, when I was writing my first book, I met and interviewed one autistic person whose parents blamed themselves for getting their children vaccinated. Another person's parents had a child who started showing autistic traits, so they delayed vaccinating a younger child for as long as they could. Indeed, the big problem with assigning blame to vaccines, Tylenol, or cold, unloving mothers is that when we're having discussions about blame, we're not having discussions about the best way to support autistic people. My fear is that the next generation of autistic Americans will be incalculably worse off than previous generations. While in the past, many were searching around in the dark, grasping for ideas and better understanding around autism, this time the federal government will be blaring disinformation with the biggest megaphones, and instead of fighting for their kids, scores of parents will self-flagellate and kick themselves, and we all will be the poorer for it. Let's check in with Blind New World, a blog site operated by the Perkins School for the Blind, and you can find them online at blindnewworld.org. The Power and Poetry in Accessible Communication. Hearing and sight loss due to Usher syndrome made it difficult for poet Matthew Harris to effectively stay in touch with friends, family, and community, until he discovered free, accessible communication through iCanConnect. I'm Matthew Harris, a 65-year-old poet from Maryland who's living with Usher syndrome, a genetic condition that has led me to being blind with increasing hearing loss. At first, Usher syndrome made it hard to stay connected with family, friends, and my community. But I'm now rediscovering the joy of communication and connection with iCanConnect, the National Deafblind Equipment Distribution Program. It's a nationwide program that offers free distance communication equipment, training, and local contacts to qualified individuals who, like me, have significant combined hearing and vision loss. Sensory loss doesn't have to mean a loss of connection. Before iCanConnect, the isolation that often accompanies dual sensory loss was a daily reality for me. I struggled with essential tasks like texting and navigating through emails. My wife learned about iCanConnect through a Facebook support group for spouses of individuals with Usher syndrome. I applied to the program, and once I was accepted, my local representative met with me to discuss my needs and goals. Then I get everything I needed, including a computer, a Braille display, a smartphone, headphones, and a smartphone keyboard, In addition to the equipment, I received training on how to use my new tech. And the training was excellent. My trainers were very knowledgeable about the technology and possessed a tremendous amount of patience. They set up my computer and cell phone and helped me master Outlook for email, a program I had always found challenging. After training, I am now a confident Outlook user and find it easier to use as a totally blind person than I did when I still had some sight. My iCan Connect trainers also set up a Braille display and connected it to my computer, integrating it with JAWS, the audio assistive software I use. This combination has been a game changer. It allows me to read what's on the computer screen in Braille, which not only helps me feel more connected to the world, but also allows me to read and edit messages more effectively. For example, JAWS uses a sound effect to indicate uppercase letters. With my hearing loss, I cannot pick up the tone, but with the Braille display, I can feel it. I can feel if the letter is uppercase or not. As my hearing loss progresses, I know I will still be able to communicate effectively using the Braille display that I received through iCan Connect. The powerful positive impact of accessible communication. The impact on my daily life has been huge. As a result of the equipment and training I received through iCan Connect, I'm able to participate better in everyday communications. Simple interactions that many take for granted, like a text message from my daughter saying, "Hey Dad, just left the house, I'll be there in 20 minutes," or being included in a group text about a loved one's condition, are now possible for me. We often take for granted such simple communication encounters such as these. That is, until something like deafblindness disconnects us from them. I'm a strong advocate for iCan Connect and highly recommend the program to anyone who would like to get reconnected to their family and friends. I have already shared information about the program with a former social worker, and my wife has spread the word in her online support group. I quite often tell people how iCan Connect has been an answer to my prayers. Communication builds confidence. Beyond everyday communication, iCan Connect has empowered me to continue pursuing my passion for poetry. By further expanding, on my own, the skills I've learned from iCan Connect to communicate through emailing and texting, I can still reach the community at large with my poetry. I recently wrote a poem, "Where I Go," to bring awareness to the experience of living with blindness and hearing loss, and I am currently working on a poetic novel. Although this book is not about blindness or deafness, it will show what a person with dual sensory challenges can achieve, and that's largely because I can connect, pun intended, by the way. And if you have just joined us, you are listening to the Blindness and Disability News Hour from Mind's Eye Radio. This program covers the week of September 14th, 2025. Thanks for joining us. And now, back to the program. For our next story, we're going to pay a visit to the American Foundation for the Blind, and you can find them online at afb.org. We're going to hear about, and that means that we are paying a visit to Access World Magazine, a publication of the American Foundation for the Blind, by the way, folks. We're going to hear about Yelp and TripAdvisor, two business review platforms for travel and more. And this was written by Janet Ingber. Online reviews and ratings have become an essential part of modern decision-making. Two of the most popular platforms are Yelp, which primarily focuses on businesses, and TripAdvisor, which specializes in travel. Both platforms generate their ratings by consolidating feedback from users. Whenever you make a purchase online or in person, you are often prompted to rate the product or service. This is how these websites collect their data. However, keep in mind that reviews are not verified against personal biases. Anyone can create an account, and in some cases, reviewers may even be connected to the business. For example, my experience at a motel contradicted its glowing reviews. The room was dirty, smelled unpleasant, and had a malfunctioning air conditioner and a broken door lock, and I even found a spider and a web in the shower. This highlights an important truth. While anyone can post a review, credibility grows when a business has a large number of reviews from different people. For this article, I used an iPhone running iOS 18.6 and an M1 Mac with Mac OS Sequoia 15.6. First, let's hear about Yelp and the iOS app, which can be downloaded for free on the Apple App Store. The Yelp app is free to download for iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. And simply search for Yelp in the App Store. When you first open the app, you'll be prompted to sign in. You can create an account with your email address or sign in with Apple or Google. Yelp will also request permission to use your location. Exploring the app. The Yelp app features five main tabs along the bottom: Search, Projects, Me, Collections, and More. A vertical scroll bar appears on the right side of the screen. Each tab contains a wealth of information, so I'll provide just a few examples. First, there's Search. This brings up a search field with clearly displayed results and filters for narrowing them down. Projects focuses on home repair and renovation services, such as electricians, contractors, and remodelers. And then there's Me, displays your reservations, reviews, and businesses you've interacted with. Then there's Collections, offers curated lists of businesses such as restaurants, bakeries, and brunch spots. And finally, there's More, provides access to food orders, reservations, and messages, along with options for events, settings, support, and finding friends. At the top of the screen is a quick access list of popular searches: restaurants, plumbers, etc. Selecting More expands the list to categories like electricians, snacks and drinks, spas and salons. And All Categories option is also available and works well with headings navigation. Categories include health and medicine, arts and entertainment, and pets. Selecting Pets, for instance, reveals subcategories such as grooming, emergency pet hospital, and pet insurance, each with detailed listings that include distance, addresses, reviews, and star ratings. Searching is intuitive. When I entered bakery in the search form, results appeared instantly. After selecting one, I found all relevant details and even visited the bakery, which turned out to be excellent. Leaving a review is straightforward. You assign a star rating, 1 to 5, then write and post your review. Overall, Yelp's iOS app is highly accessible. The screens are uncluttered and simple to navigate. And then let's take a look at the Yelp website. And you can find Yelp online at yelp.com. That's Y-E-L-P.com. The Yelp website contains extensive information, much like the app. However, navigation can be frustrating. Pages sometimes load unexpectedly without input, and navigating by headings, links, and forms isn't always reliable. Pop-up menus may fail to open, and account creation can be cumbersome. In short, while the content is there, the experience is less user-friendly than the app. And now let's take a look at TripAdvisor. First, the iOS app, which is available for download on the App Store. The TripAdvisor app requires iOS 18.0 and later on iPhone or iPad. And upon launch, the app asks you to use your location. In my case, it correctly identified it. You're also prompted to sign in, either by creating an account or continuing with Apple or Google. I chose Google, and since I have multiple accounts, I simply selected the one I wanted. The first screen displayed weekend getaway recommendations near me, along with a $30 welcome offer and a button to explore member benefits. At the bottom are five tabs: Home, Search, Trips, Review, and Account. Like Yelp, the app also includes a vertical scroll bar on the right, which displayed nearby restaurants as I navigated it. First, the tabs. Home highlights weekend getaways, tours abroad, and U.S. destinations. Selecting an option reveals price, description, ratings, and reviews. Search. This features a search box, followed by options for popular and nearby. Results adapt based on your choice, and you can save items for later. Searching Alaska, for example, brought up categories such as overview, things to do, and hotels. Choosing things to do prompted me to select a city, which then generated a list of activities. Trips helps plan vacations by entering where and when you want to travel. TripAdvisor makes recommendations and provides reviews. And speaking of reviews, there's the Review tab that allows you to write reviews of places you've visited. This section was somewhat confusing as I encountered error messages despite entering everything correctly. And finally, there's Account. Provides help, booking management, and chat options. And let's take a look at the TripAdvisor website. And you can find them online at tripadvisor.com. That's TripAdvisor.com. At the top of the homepage is a sign-in option. Unfortunately, I repeatedly received an incorrect password error when attempting to sign in with my Google account, even though the credentials were correct. The login prompt also popped up again after being dismissed. The main navigation tabs include Search All, Hotels, Things to Do, Restaurants, Flights, and Vacation Rentals. Besides these is a search button, which opens a field to enter your destination. Results appear in a section adjacent to the navigation bar. When I searched for Alaska, numerous results appeared similar to the app. Overall, the website is information-rich, but not overwhelming. Navigation by forms, headings, and links worked well, but because of the sheer volume of information, I recommend using VoiceOver's Find command, that's Control-Option-F, to quickly locate items. And in conclusion, the app versions of Yelp and TripAdvisor are generally easier to navigate than their websites. The apps avoid clutter, and their tab structures make browsing more efficient. The Yelp website offers plenty of information but can be frustrating to navigate. The TripAdvisor website is usable overall but less user-friendly compared to the streamlined app. For accessibility and ease of use, the apps are the stronger choice. Our next story on this week's program comes from Science Norway. And you can find them at sciencenorway.no. This is how blind people can play video games. Gaming is no longer just for the sighted. Blind players are ready, and with built-in auditory navigation, it's time developers got in the game too. This is written by Alexander Espeseth, and it was published on September 3rd. Video games have become a major part of modern entertainment. Yet, for players with visual impairments, access remains a significant challenge. Sound-based navigation can make video games more accessible to blind players, ensuring that they can enjoy and be immersed in interactive experiences on equal footing with sighted players. My study lays the groundwork for a more inclusive gaming industry. By developing and testing a new framework for accessible game design, it demonstrates that integrating robust auditory navigation systems into games can bridge the gap. A win-win for developers and gamers. The gaming industry has made strides in accessibility, but most solutions are costly and developed by AAA studios, which is why the video game equivalent of a Hollywood production from the world of movies. This limits the possibilities for smaller studios to afford to make their games tailored for the blind players. Sadly, blind players are often forced to rely on unofficial modifications or workarounds to play mainstream or indie games. For game developers, this means new opportunities to reach a broader audience by implementing built-in accessibility features rather than relying on third-party solutions. For players, it means more freedom to enjoy video games without unnecessary barriers. Organizations such as the Norwegian Association of the Blind and Partially Sighted, or Blindeforbundet, are thrilled and now collaborating with us by sending testers, reinforcing the real-world impact of this work. How was this tested? To evaluate the effectiveness of sound-based navigation, we conducted an experiment with two groups, blind players and sighted participants who played the game blindfolded to simulate different levels of visual impairment. The participants used audio cues, including a moving sound cue guiding the player towards the goal using spatial audio to inform where to move, and sound effects to navigate a game environment without any visual assistance. Data was collected on their ability to complete levels, the time required, and their experience via questionnaires. The results showed that most participants could successfully navigate the game using only auditory information, confirming that well-designed sound cues can serve as an effective tool for orientation and movement. Practical implications and the next steps. Based on our findings, the next phase of research will focus on refining this approach based on feedback from testers across different game genres and environments. We aim to create a standardized framework that game developers can easily implement in their production pipelines. To ensure practicality, we are working closely with the Norwegian game industry, including Snowcastle Games, to ensure optimal workflow for the developers, which will then again ensure upscaling in games available for the blind players. Ultimately, the goal is to establish sound-based navigation as an industry standard, making games truly accessible to all players. By combining research, industry collaboration, and direct input from blind players, we can move towards a future where video games are designed for everyone from the very beginning. For our next article, we pay a visit to AT Today, the latest news in assistive technology, and you can find them online at attoday.co.uk. And this article is somewhat related to the article we started the program with. Visually impaired cricket fans take part in trial to watch the matches using assistive technology. And this is written by Millie York and published on September 1st. Egbaston Stadium in Birmingham has completed the first ever trial of Give Vision's assistive technology, offering visually impaired fans a new way to follow live cricket. On August 8th, during the Hundreds Midlands Derby between Birmingham Phoenix and Nottingham's Trent Rockets, a select group of 9 cricket fans with varying visual impairments trialed the technology within the stadium environment. In a world first for cricket, the participants were able to watch the live matches using Give Vision headsets, powered by a private 5G network supplied by Shared Access. Using an immersive stereoscopic feed, similar to that used in virtual reality, the headsets stream live match footage to the working part of the user's retina, enhancing the individual's remaining vision and enabling them to follow the game in real time and in, unquote, unprecedented detail, unquote. The group of trial participants featured players from Birmingham Stars, a visually impaired cricket team. Teresa Roberts, a member of the UK's first women's blind cricket team, said, quote, "That was the first time I've seen a catch live and be able to see it in full detail. I've been able to see everything," unquote. Founded in 2014, Give Vision's technology enhances the match day experience for fans with sight loss by bringing the on-field action in view in real time, so they can enjoy it alongside the atmosphere of a live crowd and the company of friends and family. With 1 in 30 people facing visual impairments in the UK, the trial forms part of Edgbaston's continued efforts to expand its audience and create an inclusive environment for cricket fans. Thomas Cunningham Smith, Safeguarding and Compliance Manager at Edgbaston, commented, quote, "The live event trial with GiveVision and Shared Access allowed us to gain essential feedback from spectators with visual impairments, an important part of our work to ensure the stadium experience at Edgbaston is as inclusive as possible." Quote, "Helping visually impaired cricket fans to feel more included and experience the atmosphere of a stadium fixture live for the first time was truly moving. And we're proud to continue our efforts to ensure all fans who require additional adjustments feel safe, supported, and welcome at Edgbaston." Following the trial with GiveVision and Shared Access, the results and findings from the two trials at Edgbaston Stadium will be collated into a report, which, upon approval, will grant access to funding that will enable the technology to become a permanent fixture for Edgbaston in the near future. Joanna Liddington, head of operations at GiveVision, added, quote, "This world first in cricket meant many fans taking part in the trial could follow every ball on the pitch for the very first time while still soaking up the match day atmosphere. Thanks to Edgbaston for opening their doors to innovation and championship accessibility in cricket, and to Shared Access for providing the private 5G network, we could bring GiveVision to life and make this moment possible." The Department of Education provided £1.7 million of funding to allow children with special educational needs and disabilities to trial innovative assistive technologies. Let's pay a return visit to the current issue of Future Reflections magazine, a publication of the American Action Fund for Blind Children and Adults, and a book review. The book is titled Just Maria. It's written by Jay Hardwig, and the review is conducted by Barbara Cheadle. And Barbara Cheadle is the founding president of the National Organization of Parents of Blind Children, or NOPBC, and the founding editor of Future Reflections. She is a librarian with a special interest in children's books that portray blind characters. The book is Just Maria. It's written by Jay Hardwig. It was published in 2022 by Regal House Publishing. And it's available from Bookshare.org and from NLS Bard as catalog number DB125548. This lively little book for and about middle schoolers is engaging with a snappy pace. It manages to educate and debunk a lot of myths about blindness seamlessly and without a hint of preachiness. Just Maria was written by Jay Hardwig, a veteran teacher and orientation and mobility instructor of blind children. Within the context of the plot, the book provides details about how a 12-year-old, sixth grader Maria Romero, learns to travel safely with her folding white cane. And the cane is named Roxy, under the instruction of her cane and travel instructor, Mr. Torres. Mr. Torres teaches Maria to, quote, "use your cane and your brain and figure it out," unquote. The first chapter, intriguingly, with just the right hint of shock value, is called Undies. Right away, we learn that not all blind kids are alike. Sam, one of Maria's blind friends, grosses her out when she discovers that he doesn't bother to put away his clean undies. He just gives them the sniff test to find the clean ones if they get mixed up with the dirty laundry. Maria thinks he's just lazy, and she likes to have a place for everything and everything in its place. She lives her life, quote, by the book. Maria is conflicted about wanting more independence and also fearing it. Although Maria is 12, it was only a few months ago that her mom finally was willing to leave her alone in the house while she runs errands or stops by the gym for a workout. Frustrated, Maria muses that, quote, "sooner or later, she's going to have to let me grow up a little," unquote. Maria is also afraid of being cut loose and becoming a, quote, Maria pancake, unquote, if she fails to cross a street perfectly without Mr. Torres by her side to correct her. She lives only 4 blocks from a bakery, but she has never gone there by herself or even crossed a street alone. Mr. Torres says it won't be long, but Maria still hangs back. Above all, Maria yearns to be accepted, or at least not rejected and outright snubbed, by the popular kids, especially Hannah, cheerleader, teacher's pet, and ringleader of the popular girls. Quote, I don't expect to be a queen bee or anything, Maria reflects to herself, but I'd at least like to be part of the hive. Is that so wrong? Unquote. It's not that she likes Hannah that much. After all, the only time Hannah is nice to her is when the teachers are around. It's just, well, it's hard being stereotyped as the blind kid when all she wants to be is just Maria. One thing is sure, Maria is certain that hanging out with her next-door neighbor and classmate, weird J.J. Munson, King Geek of the sixth grade, will not enhance her chances of being accepted into Hannah's popular circle of friends. But she doesn't have much choice. J.J. is determined to be her friend and to pull her into his weird schemes, like being his partner at the Twinigens Superhero Detective Agency. It doesn't make it any easier that her single-parent mom insists that she be kind to J.J. And Maria does reluctantly admire J.J. for his gentle, genuine affection for and cheerful acceptance of his little sister, Cynthia, who is nonverbal and autistic and attends a special school. It is Cynthia who ultimately provides the circumstances for the Twinigens Detective Agency's one and only case. That case provides just the challenge Maria needs to face her fears, use the travel skills she's learned, exert her independence, and discover it's okay to, quote, zig where others zag, unquote. At first I was skeptical of the plot line, another kids become detective storyline, cue rolling my eyes. Not only does it work, but it has some interesting twists. Spoiler alert, J.J. actually succeeds in luring a reluctant Maria into his detective scheme, but they only ever actually solve one mystery. Most of the action and development of the story comes from J.J.'s insistence that they must prove themselves worthy of the title detectives. He insists that they give each other 4 challenges to test our mind and mettle, our moxie. The chapters carrying the plot are interspersed with chapters about blindness. These chapters are brief, but informative, presented in Maria's voice and perspective, and they complement the plot. Early in the book, Maria tells us about her, quote, Crabby Abby Day's top 10 list of the most annoying things about being blind, unquote. The list includes things such as people who think I'm amazing and the can you guess who this is game. This list is divided into 4 parts and makes up 4 of the chapters. And there are also 4 chapters that address, quote, things you might be wondering, unquote, such as Braille, Maria's white cane, which is named Roxy, how she became blind, retinoblastoma, and the question she gets more often, quote, do you wish you could see, unquote? And her answer is, no, not really. I recommend this book as a good read for any child or adult, and I'm a big fan of youth literature, but I especially like the way the common questions and misunderstandings about blindness are addressed and integrated into the story. And that about wraps up this week's edition of the Blindness and Disability News Hour. This program covers the week of September 14th, 2025. My name is Bill. Thanks for joining us this week. This program, as always, is a production and presentation of Mind's Eye Radio in Belleville, Illinois. Hope you all have a good rest of your week and a good weekend. Stay cool, although it looks like we're going to get a break. So we'll look forward to that. Until next time, be good, be safe. See you, bye.